Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, highlights from the 2013 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. Now, this is a two-part series, and this is the second part of the series, and this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic and finding out what's the newest, what's been the latest findings reported at ASCO, that we have so many of you on the call today. Now, we have 987 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of this country, and we also have international participants from Australia, Bulgaria, China, the United Kingdom, Venezuela, Canada, France, and Mexico. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. The next, actually, hour and a half with us, actually. Now, today's program has been made possible by educational grants from Astellas, Celgene, Genomic Health, Inc., Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, Lilly, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, Novartis Oncology, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. And I really want to thank them for their support of our program today and for their corporate participation and partnership in making this program possible. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, also about our collaborating organizations, and there also is an evaluation form. And we very much appreciate your feedback on our programs, and we actually your feedback helps to inform the programs going forward. We are planning many programs this year, and indeed this particular program is one that many of you have asked us to do year after year. But there may be other topics as well that you'd like us to offer, and so please tell us what you'd like us to do, and we're going to try very hard to do it as we plan our next programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Charles Leprinzi. He's a Regents Professor of Breast Cancer Research, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Leprinzi is going to address supportive care and quality of life issues and the updates, the research findings reported at ASCO, and the implications for the treatment of cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Leprinzi.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to participate in this conference once again. This conference is going to deal with research that was presented at the ASCO meeting, ASCO, and that stands for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And that's the main society in the world that deals with clinical cancer research issues. And every late May or early June, we get together and talk about research ongoing. And my job here, other than to give you this brief introduction about the ASCO meeting, is to talk about topics regarding symptom control issues. And by that I mean that there are many symptoms that are caused by cancer and or cancer therapy, and symptom control research aims to try to find ways to prevent and or treat such symptoms caused by cancer and or cancer therapy. So the first one I want to talk about deals with chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, and a number of drugs such as oxaliplatin, others cisplatinum, and taxane medications can have a side effect from them that causes numbness, tingling, shooting, burning pains, often in the hands and the feet primarily, and these can be prominent problems that usually comes on with as you get the drug, more of the drug, and it can be a persistent problem after a person finishes chemotherapy, although in some patients it gets better, but for some it's a persistent problem. So with FOLFOX, it's a treatment that has oxaliplatinum, is it, commonly used for colon cancer treatment and other treatments of the abdominal cavity, other cancers of the abdominal cavity, and it causes a lot of this problem. There were data presented about 9 years ago that suggested that intravenous calcium and magnesium would help prevent this particular problem and cut it down by about 50%. So a lot of patients, physicians started using this, up to about 50% of physicians started using it, even though it hadn't been as rigorously studied as we ideally like things to be rigorously studied. But at this year's annual meeting, there was an abstract presented. I know it well because I actually presented it, with a randomized placebo-controlled trial with people getting this chemotherapy, and half got calcium and magnesium intravenously before they started the chemotherapy, and then afterwards. Each before and afterwards takes 30 minutes, so it's not inconsequential, or a placebo. And the bottom line was that the calcium magnesium didn't work. So there was kind of a sigh of relief at the meeting saying, at least we know this doesn't work and we can move on and try to find something different and not have people have to receive this extra hour of therapy in the chemotherapy chair. Moving on now, let me talk about another area, and that is something called aromatase inhibitor arthralgias. And aromatase inhibitors are hormonal or anti-estrogen medications we use for patients with breast cancer. And one of the side effects they can cause is joint aches and pains. And they cause these problems in about 50%, that's 50% of women. And they're a really prominent problem in about 15%, that's 15% of women, to the point where they say, I can't tolerate this medication, even though it's trying to help my cancer, is just making me miserable. So there was a report here of a randomized trial looking at acupuncture. And it was a relatively small trial, but it supported that, in fact, acupuncture made these joint aches and pains better. There have been a couple of other such studies which have also suggested that. And so it's an exciting thing to be thinking about for us as physicians. There's a randomized trial going on throughout the United States in a multi-institutional process, similar to what we did with this calcium-magnesium study that I just talked about later on. And hopefully results from that will demonstrate that there's benefit for that. So some suggestion of acupuncture being helpful, but not absolute proof of that at this time. Next topic I want to cover deals with a big problem in patients with cancer, especially even in cancer, patients with curatively treated cancer who are getting chemotherapy to try to prevent recurrence, something we call adjuvant chemotherapy, and in patients with advanced cancer where it's not where their cancer is actually there and not just trying to increase the risk rate of cure. And that problem is fatigue. There have been a lot of things that have been tried for this thing, methylphenidate, which is the scientific name for what a lot of people know as Ritalin, a stimulant, modafinil and Provigil. And there was a trial this year looking at the modafinil medication, placebo-controlled trial in patients with lung cancer who were having trouble with fatigue. They were randomized to get the modafinil or a placebo medication. And there was improvement in fatigue, but it was equal in both groups, whether you got the placebo or the modafinil. So this is what we call a placebo effect, and there was no suggestion that modafinil added things in terms of benefit. There actually was pretty good data that it added some toxicity data because we had people on placebo or modafinil and asked them about any symptoms they might have, which might be from toxic medications from the therapy, and it was more prominent in the patients who were getting the active medication. Similar studies, again, have showed that with methylphenidate or Ritalin in the past, so the less and less interest about giving stimulants for cancer fatigue. The best suggestion out there is actually that ginseng might be helpful, and more data will be coming out for that in the literature in the near future. So the next thing I'm going to turn to is related to a medication we oftentimes give to patients who have bony metastases, so that's cancer spread to the bones, where the cancer can grow in the bones and cause trouble and pain and fractures and need for radiation therapy. And there's a medication that we give that tries to turn off the bone cells that chew up the bone called the osteoclasts. And these medications have been used for patients to try to prevent the bone metastasis from getting worse. And also, we use these medications if sometimes the calcium is elevated in the blood of some patients with cancer, and that's coming from the bone, which is being destroyed. And the same set of medications has been used in patients with osteoporosis, or thin bones, that do not have cancer. So there's two types of medications. One is what we call a bisphosphonate, like zoledronic acid, or zoledronate, or Zometa, similar to medications that others might know as brand names as Fosamax or Beneva or Alendronate is a generic name for those. And when patients get these medications, there's another set of medications called denosumab or Xgeva, and they work in slightly different ways, but they have the same effect. So they looked at this medication, this denosumab, and they saw that in about 10% of patients, they got hypocalcemia. So that means low calcium, too low calcium. You need calcium to be in moderate level to be good for you. If it's hypercalcemia, it's too high from the cancer, and that has to be brought down by these medications. But when the calcium gets too low, that can cause a lot of problems also. So it's important for doctors now, as they see this, to beware of that thing that the calcium doesn't get too low. If patients are on these medications, it's important for them to take calcium and vitamin D to help prevent this particular problem. Let me move on to another area, and that deals with nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, and virtually everybody is aware of that phenomenon, different amounts with different chemotherapy agents. There's a medication that's been given to help try to prevent that problem. It's called aprepitant, or the brand name of that is Emend. And there's a newer that medication is given for 3 days, on the day of chemotherapy and 2 days thereafterwards. So there's a newer version of that medication called fosaprepitant, or Emend for injection. And that way, the medication can be given intravenously in the arm at the same time that chemotherapy is given. It doesn't have to be given for the next 2 days. That sometimes is less expensive for patients in terms of insurance coverage for things. So there were two abstracts that were available that actually looked at this use of this fosaprepitant, this Emend for injection. And let me back up a bit. A recent study showed that the fosaprepitant was equivalent to aprepitant in terms of which is the IV versus the oral formulation, in terms of decreasing nausea and vomiting. And there was a suggestion in that paper that it was a slightly higher chance for the people who got it intravenously to get some venous irritation, about a 3% chance of venous irritation, which is pain around the vein or swelling, versus about 1% in the people who got it orally. Well, what these other two abstracts demonstrated that when you give this medication through peripheral intravenous things, which means like in the arm as opposed to a central catheter, that the incidence of vein troubles is more like about 40%, and it's very substantial, especially when patients are getting adriamycin treatment or adriamycin and cyclophosphamide treatment. So physicians being aware of that is important. In terms of nausea and vomiting, also prevention of this nausea and vomiting, there was some suggestive evidence that gabapentin, the brand name for that is Neurontin, would decrease nausea and vomiting, but a placebo-controlled trial was not able to demonstrate that that was the truth in this situation. So I have two other things to go over here. One is that when patients have bony metastases, so cancer that spread to the bone that caused pain or fracture or interfere with the spinal cord, that radiation therapy is given. The classic way of doing that over the years has been to give 10 treatments over 10 weekdays, through Monday through Friday, through 2 weeks of treatment. But more and more information is coming out that you can give a single higher dose instead of having to give all of those 10 treatments, and that's much more convenient for patients. And lastly, let me talk about one thing that it was an interesting study where a physician took patients who had breast cancer, all known disease was removed. They were receiving adjuvant chemotherapy, somewhat we talked about before, therapy to try to increase the chance that the cancer would not come back. And what they did is they had the patients fill out a questionnaire. It was a questionnaire that looks to see if people have depression. But there are also people that on these questionnaires, they don't have depression, but they have some what we call depressive symptoms. So they're just a little bit blue, but not depression where we clearly think we need to give an antidepressant. But if they had the depressive symptoms, and they put 357 patients on this study who filled out the questionnaire, 203 of them, or 57%, had some depressive symptoms. And then they agreed to participate in the study, and they were randomized to get an antidepressant called fluoxetine, or most people may know that as Prozac, one of the older new antidepressants, if you will, versus placebo. And what they were able to demonstrate is that the people who got the fluoxetine had an improvement in their quality of life. They had a higher chance of completing the adjuvant chemotherapy that they were planning to get, and they had decreased depressive symptoms. And for the patients with low-stage disease in each group, more people were doing well at 5 years without recurrence of the cancer, presumably because they got more of the chemotherapy. So that's a quick snapshot of the symptom control trials, and I thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leprinzi. That was wonderful and really just a wonderful highlight of the ASCO meeting in terms of a focus on really symptom management, which is so very important in quality of life issues for everybody on the call today. So thank you very much for doing such a wonderful job. We all felt like we were there and really heard the best of the best. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Ruane Chair in Thoracic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and he's also Professor of Medicine, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Criss is going to address lung cancer updates, research findings reported at ASCO, as well as implications for the treatment of lung cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Criss.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. At the meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, all kinds of topics were addressed, and just a quick reminder of the treatments for lung cancers. We have three general kinds of treatments. For patients that have cancer of the lung that is confined to the lung, the treatment is surgery, very successful, becoming safer and less lifestyle disrupting every week. For patients that have cancer that has spread from the lung but still remains in the chest, the use of surgery and radiation with chemotherapy. And for cancer that has spread from the lung to other organs of the body, chemotherapy is our standard. I think we heard many different abstracts at ASCO this year that showed that, again, surgery can cure a huge proportion of patients, that the combination of surgery and radiation can not only cure patients but clearly increase the life of those people that receive that treatment, even if they're not cured, and that chemotherapy continues to be a kind of treatment that can benefit virtually every patient, both in terms of lengthening life and decreasing the symptoms of cancer as well. So I think all the things that we know were all reinforced, and in fact, in all those areas, things are a little bit better. Just a quick reminder, and again, perhaps the biggest development in the lung cancer field in many years, and that is the emergence of screening. There are probably 8 million people in the United States today who can have their chance of dying from lung cancer decreased by having a simple CAT scan, what they call a low-dose helical CAT scan. So if you are between the ages of 55 and 75, if you smoke the equivalent of a pack a day for 30 years or 30 pack years, I strongly urge that you speak to your physician about getting a low-dose CT scan. This scan is, again, quick, painless, relatively inexpensive, and has been shown conclusively to lower your risk of dying of lung cancer, something that we seldom have had the chance to offer people for the last decades that have spanned my career. I think the biggest developments at ASCO this year were further development of this whole area of what we would call personalized care, personalized medicine, precision medicine is the other word. And this is not a new concept, but I think we saw many new steps and new advances along the goal of trying to personalize the care for each and every patient. We've always had the ability to look under the microscope and see what kind of cancer a person would have in their lung. Is it small cell cancer, adenocarcinoma, prescribing certain chemo treatments based on the type of cancer, but even more now, we're able to do genetic testing. And we saw three different abstracts that were presented there. The first was from a group that 14 centers are part of across the United States, the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium. They reported their experience in looking at 1,000 patients tested from across the country that we were able to find a genetic driver that could be used as a target for treatment in two-thirds of the patients, 64%. The other thing that we saw in that trial was that the kind of mutation that was found was very important. People know that if you have an EGFR mutation, you're very likely to have a benefit from a drug like erlotinib or gefitinib. However, what the Lung Cancer Consortium also saw was about 20% of patients with EGFR mutations had types of EGFR mutations that are not going to be sensitive to erlotinib. So in addition to that information, the presence of the mutation, the type is very, very important because for those patients, chemotherapy would be a much better choice and would give a greater chance of benefit. And I think that word has gotten out to the doctors. We saw an amazing example of how a whole country can be energized to do this. investigators from France showed that in France, for over 2 years now, they have managed to test every single patient with lung cancer for these mutations, and they found tens of thousands of these mutations in people in France with lung cancers. So I think that's a great example where a whole country can do this, can find these genetic drivers and lead to better therapies, and there are many examples of that. And lastly, there was a presentation from a company called Foundation Medicine. And this is one of many companies in the United States that do genetic testing. And I think the important thing about this is that we have companies now that can test the tumor specimens that come from any laboratory, any pathology department in the United States. So every doctor in the United States has that capability to have this testing done. And this is one example where the testing could be done. I mean, your doctor can send this test out no matter where you are. And because the standard testing for EGFR and ALK is covered by treatment guidelines, it would be covered by insurance. So that's something that's now available to everybody in the United States, and I think that piece of news came out as well. We also saw more targets. People had several abstracts talking about a new gene target called RET, R-E-T. R-E-T is different from EGFR or ALK or the other targets that have been described. And there were examples shown that when this RET target was found, it could be treated with drugs that are currently available. The drug cabozantinib would be one. The drug vindetinib would be another one that could be used if you have one of these RET or ROS fusion gene changes. So more testing, more targets, and again, more drugs. I mentioned the cabozantinib already. There was a presentation about the drug dabrafenib. It turns out that some patients with lung cancers have a mutation in BRAF, the BRAF gene. This is the same gene where the damage is found in patients with melanoma. Drugs have been available, the vemurafenib, and now dabrafenib is available to treat those patients with melanoma. Persons with lung cancer that have this genetic change also can have benefit, and that was shown there. There was more information about using crizotinib, the medicine used for ALK-rearranged lung cancers, that it works for another kind of lung cancer called ROS, R-O-S-1, R-O-S-1. Again, this ROS-1 genetic abnormality was discussed last year. More information on it this year, and there's more testing for this now. So this is an additional test that can be done on a tumor specimen that is found to be negative to EGFR or ALK. And another abstract that had interest was the development of a new agent, a Clovis compound. This compound is able to attack the mutant kinase of EGFR. Patients that have EGFR mutations that get treated with EGFR-targeted agents, after a while, the cancer finds a way to grow. The way the cancer does that is a second mutation develops. This new agent, the Clovis compound, C-L-O-V-I-S, was shown in some patients to be able to work even in this doubly mutant resistant tumor situation. So I think that was very hopeful news, and we're going to hear more about this. Other drugs are available in that space as well. AstraZeneca is developing a drug like that in addition. I mentioned the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium before. They did have one very interesting piece of information, and that is that they looked at those patients that had drivers that got a targeted therapy, those that did not get a targeted therapy, and those that had a targeted therapy clearly lived longer. So I think that was a very important piece of news. We've often felt that treating with a targeted therapy made a lot of sense in terms of toxicity. Here's an example of where receiving a targeted therapy, if you have a target, means that you'll have a longer life with lung cancer, all the more reason to do that testing and do comprehensive testing at the start. What about the future? Again, even with our genetically based therapies, they're not all successful, and many of them, as I mentioned, stop working at some point. We have to look to other ways to fight the lung cancer. And one way that is emerging is for the use of drugs that specifically enhance the immune system. And the cancers in the body are fought by a certain kind of immune cell, the so-called T cell. The T cell has many control features on it. Once it's activated in the body, it can be turned off. But what scientists have found is they can find ways to inactivate these mechanisms that the cancer does to turn off the T cells. So in essence, these new drugs turn off the cancer's ability to turn off our own immune-fighting cells. There's a drug already available for melanoma, ipilimumab. There's a new class of drugs, nivolumab is one of them. These are drugs that target PD-L1 or PD-1. And these help the body use your own immune cells to fight the cancer. And again, there was data shown where these medicines do work in people with lung cancer, that they potently affect the immune system, and they work in a complementary way to chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. So I think we're very hopeful that this will give us yet another way to fight the cancer and be complementary to the therapies that we have. So I think this was a good ASCO. It shows we have further development in this field. We have many new therapies, and I encourage you to please, you know, speak to your doctor, make sure that you have the testing done that can find these targets, and that where a target is found, that every effort be made to treat your lung cancer based on the presence of that target. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris. That was really outstanding and just very insightful, very exciting in terms of all that you reported upon, and very good information for everybody to take back to the treating healthcare team. So thank you so much. That was really, really wonderful. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrea Sirsak, and Dr. Sirsak is an assistant attending physician, gastrointestinal oncology service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Sirsak is going to address colorectal cancer updates, research findings reported at ASCO, as well as implications for the treatment of colorectal cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Sirsak.
Thank you. So today I'll review some of the key presentations in the metastatic colorectal cancer that were presented at ASCO. We've learned that in the adjuvant setting, or in patients who have had resection for colorectal cancer, combinations of chemotherapy or added chemotherapies do not always improve outcomes. So addition of targeted agents to our standard chemotherapy backbones may not have shown to not improve outcomes for patients that had resected stage 2 or 3 disease. A large part of the discussion, the focus of the discussions at ASCO this year, were addressing this question in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer treated with first-line therapy, so newly diagnosed patients treated with chemotherapy for the first time. The first study was known as the FIRE-3 study. Looked at patients who had stage 4 disease and had what's known as KRAS wild-type tumors. Now, these are tumors that do not have a gene mutation. And we've learned from prior studies that patients that do not have this mutation are eligible for an additional, for a targeted therapy known as cetuximab. And this is a targeted agent that targets the growth protein. So patients with KRAS wild-type tumors were treated with either our standard backbone chemotherapy known as FOLFIRI. This is 5-FU, leucovorin, and irinotecan, with the addition of cetuximab, or the standard backbone FOLFIRI with the addition of bevacizumab, which is a targeted agent that targets a protein that controls blood vessel growth. So this was a large study, and patients were randomized into either group. In the end, the results showed that there was no difference in tumor shrinkage with either the addition of either targeted agent, either cetuximab or bevacizumab. There was a slight trend in the cetuximab group of a better long-term outcome, but this really could not be explained. The second study was also a very important study in that it addressed patients with stage 4 colorectal cancer that had involvement with that had liver metastases. So these were patients that are potentially eligible for resection of liver tumors and could then be rendered cancer-free. And we learned from a large study back in 2008 that in such patients, giving chemotherapy before the surgery actually improved outcomes. So it really benefited these patients to have some chemotherapy prior to undergoing resection. So this year, the study that was presented was known as the new EPOC study, and this evaluated, again, the question of targeted agents with the addition of a standard backbone chemotherapy that we use in stage 4 cancer. So these patients also had to have KRAS wild-type tumors and were treated with either FOLFOX, which is 5-FU leucovorin and oxaliplatin, or CAPOX, capecitabine and oxaliplatin, or FOLFIRI, 5-FU leucovorin and irinotecan, and the addition of cetuximab to all three of these chemos. And the patients received this treatment for 12 weeks before surgery and then 12 weeks after surgery. And the idea really was to see if the combination not only helps patients get to the operating room, but also helps long-term improve disease-free, help patients stay disease-free longer. And this study actually underwent early analysis, and it showed that there was no improvement in getting patients to the operating room with the addition of cetuximab. So again, the addition of cetuximab here didn't show an improvement in getting the patients to the operating room. It did, however, raise several important questions, which will serve as a springboard for future studies, in that some patients that received FOLFIRI did better with the combination of cetuximab than the patients who received FOLFOX or CAPOX. And we have seen these in prior studies as well, that cetuximab tends to work better with irinotecan. So the questions that will be raised and are raised in current ongoing studies are what is the molecular signature and why do some of these tumors work better than others? And that's a very, very important topic that's being addressed at the moment. The third study, known as the TRIBE study, also treated a large number of patients newly diagnosed first treatment for stage 4 disease with a combination of either FOLFIRI, which is our standard backbone, plus bevacizumab, which targets the blood vessels, or a combination of all of our standard agents known as FOLFOX-IRI. So this is 5-FU leucovorin, oxaliplatin, plus irinotecan, with the addition of bevacizumab. Again, this was a large group of patients, over 500 patients, that were randomized to either treatment. The combination did improve tumor shrinkage, and it did improve long-term outcomes slightly, but it did not improve or did not increase the ability of these patients to undergo resection. So it did not improve their chances of getting to the operating room. But an important point here is that the combination, so the FOLFOX-IRI, the combination of all three standard drugs, did have more side effects. It was generally well tolerated, but it did have more side effects than the common two-drug arm treatment option. And this is very, very important for our patients, as quality of life is hugely important, and potentially subjecting people to harsher regimens, which are more difficult to tolerate, is not the right thing to do if the outcomes are not significantly better. One very exciting thing, however, to come out of this study was that they did subgroup analysis of certain types of gene mutations. And particularly, we know that a gene mutation known as BRAF in stage 4 colorectal cancer is very difficult in that it is difficult to treat. And people with the patients with the mutation may not do as well, and that the tumors are not as responsive to chemotherapy. Well, in this subgroup on this study, there were actually responses to the FOLFOX-IRI, so the three-drug combination regimen, which is encouraging because, again, it is such a challenging tumor type to treat. So certainly more studies will be done on this topic, and there are numerous studies currently ongoing for BRAF-mutated colon cancers, but it is interesting that even the standard sort of cytotoxic chemotherapy that we have for stage 4 disease does seem to work better in this tumor subtype as well. The remaining presentations really focused on quality of life, which again is extremely important in patients with stage 4 disease, where the goal is obviously to prolong life but also to maintain or improve the quality of life. So one very important side effect of our chemotherapy is the numbness and tingling or the neurotoxicity associated with oxaliplatin. And oxaliplatin is a drug that we use both in stage 2 or 3 disease where the patients are treated with curative intent, as well as in stage 4 disease where the patients are treated long-term, again, to prolong life and to improve the quality of life. The neurotoxicity or the numbness and tingling associated with oxaliplatin can be a permanent side effect that can adversely affect a patient's life in that sometimes they can't button buttons or they drop books. It can be quite severe. So the question of how do we improve or prevent oxaliplatin neurotoxicity has been very important for us. So this study was a large study. Again, over 300 patients were treated with intravenous calcium and magnesium versus placebo, so sugar water, to see if calcium and magnesium does in fact prevent or minimize oxaliplatin-associated numbness and tingling. This was done because there was a smaller study done a few years ago that did show some hint of improvement with neurotoxicity with infusion of calcium and magnesium. So in this study, patients that were undergoing actually adjuvant therapy, so these were patients with stage 3 disease receiving FOLFOX, so 5-FU-leucovorin and oxaliplatin, were placed into any one of three arms. The first arm, they were treated with intravenous calcium and magnesium before and after oxaliplatin. The second arm, it was placebo before or after, and the third arm was calcium and magnesium. It was calcium and magnesium before and placebo after chemotherapy. And the patients were evaluated both for long-term or cumulative numbness and tingling, as well as acute numbness and tingling that happens close to the within a few days of the infusion. And unfortunately, the results showed that the calcium and magnesium did not reduce the risk of numbness and tingling. And so the recommendation is really that this extra infusion time or this extra time spent in the infusion suite does not benefit patients in terms of numbness and tingling. So we as oncologists have to be as vigilant as we've been, if not more vigilant, and really looking for early signs of oxaliplatin-induced numbness and tingling to try to dose reduce or hold the drug before this seriously affects our patient's quality of life. And the last study addressed the question of maintenance therapy in stage 4 disease, which is a combination of capecitabine, that is an oral version of 5-FU, and bevacizumab versus observation after standard induction treatment with chemotherapy and bevacizumab. This study showed in the end that the addition or the continuation of therapy did slightly improve tumor control, but did not change long-term outcomes. So this is a bit of a debate as to whether or not this is something that is of value for our patients. Typically, capecitabine and bevacizumab is not extremely toxic to our patients, and most can tolerate it well. However, if there are significant side effects, this is an important study to think about in that really it does not change long-term outcomes. So there's a question of whether or not patients should be subjected to ongoing chemotherapy, although, again, there was a bit of improvement in tumor control growth. So that is a question that begs to be answered, and there are numerous studies looking at this as well in terms of was this combination too heavy? Is it better to do just one drug as maintenance therapy? There are many, many questions that remain to be answered and much more research that needs to be done. But I do think that the studies presented at ASCO this year did provide interesting springboards for future studies, and we will continue to address the question not only of outcomes but also of quality of life while on treatment of our patients.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Sirsak. That was a wonderful presentation, a very informative, and actually very helpful to understand all of the research that's going on and the focus of the research, both being on both in terms of improving outcome as well as quality of life issues. That's so important for everybody undergoing treatment. So thank you so much for that wonderful presentation from ASCO. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly, and Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Associate Professor, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to address pancreatic cancer updates, research findings reported at ASCO, and implications for the treatment of pancreatic cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Carolyn, thank you very much. Greetings, everybody, from New York. I have the pleasure this afternoon of updating what happened in the pancreas cancer arena from the recent ASCO meeting. And I'm going to start off with a potentially practice-changing combination of medications that was evaluated in North America and internationally, looking at gemcitabine and a drug called nab-paclitaxel, also known as Abraxane. And this study was called the IMPACT study, and it was conducted in patients with newly diagnosed metastatic pancreas cancer. And it was comparing the two-drug combination of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel to gemcitabine. These results have been eagerly anticipated and have shown that the combination results in a greater degree of control of the cancer, a greater ability to shrink the cancer, and indeed patients living longer. So those results are encouraging, and this particular combination is now beginning to be embraced in various settings of treating pancreas cancer. For example, it's going to become an option for people with newly diagnosed pancreas cancer, which is spread. Studies are planned to look at this particular combination in the postoperative setting, where the goal is to prevent the recurrence of pancreas cancer. That's called the adjuvant setting, and such a study will start early next year. And in addition, there are plans to look at it in the what's called the locally advanced or non-operable but localized pancreas cancer setting. The other, I think, importance of this particular program is that it potentially provides a platform for adding other medications, so new medications that are not FDA approved but could have potential benefit in pancreas cancer in terms of being added to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. And already we're beginning to see a series of trials that are underway that are evaluating this particular combination. Other things I think that are important to note are that this combination of medications is relatively manageable for patients who have a reasonable level of functioning, main things being fatigue, potential for a drop in the blood counts, and neuropathy or pins and needles and numbness in the fingers and toes. That's mostly manageable and related to the cumulative dosing. So I think it's nice to have options in this disease, and we're certainly glad to have one more. And this is a common consideration in the treatment of pancreas cancer. So a second study that also has the potential, although not immediately in the U.S., for practice change is results from the JESPAC-1 study. These data were presented by Dr. Fuku Tomi from Japan, and it was evaluating a drug called S1, which is an oral version of 5-FU. 5-FU is a commonly used medication in the treatment of pancreas cancer. And this particular drug, S1, was compared to gemcitabine in the postoperative preventative setting. So this is a trial conducted in the adjuvant setting, where the goals of treatment are to maximize the chances of the cancer not coming back. This study was designed as a head-to-head comparison of this oral 5-FU or S1 to gemcitabine, and the results were provocative in that S1 appeared to be not only equivalent to gemcitabine in terms of its benefit, but even the suggestion that it actually might be a superior medication to gemcitabine. So at least in Asia, these results have direct application to current medical practice in that this drug potentially will displace gemcitabine in the postoperative setting. However, its development in North America and in Europe is not entirely clear at the moment, and part of the reason for this is that S1 may be metabolized differently in people who are of non-Asian heritage and may have a different side effect profile and indeed different effectiveness in non-Asians. And studies need to be done in North America and Europe to evaluate whether the initial promise of S1 in Japan is replicated in the European and North American setting. One can't just assume it, even though we might like to be able to do so. However, I do think that there's more to come on this particular medication, in that it also has shown some hints of benefit in advanced pancreas cancer where the disease has spread. So again, practice changing in Asia, possibly further trials to more fully elucidate its benefits in Europe and North America. So moving now to a third area which has implications for practice is results from the anticipated LAP07 trial. This study was presented by Dr. Beaujean from Dr. Hamel from Beaujean in France. And it was a study conducted in locally advanced pancreas cancer. So this is a population of people with pancreas cancer which is involving key blood vessels but hasn't spread to other areas of the body. And there were really two major questions being asked in this fairly large study. Firstly, does the addition of a medication called erlotinib, also known as Tarceva, does that improve outcomes when added to gemcitabine in the setting of localized or stage 3 pancreas cancer? And secondly, does adding radiation, and here we mean actually a combination of chemotherapy and radiation, to gemcitabine in that same patient population after an initial period of chemotherapy, is that a better way to go as opposed to continuing chemotherapy on its own? And this latter question in particular is a very significant one and has direct implications for how we might approach a patient with localized pancreas cancer. So the results were perhaps not as expected in that despite the initial promise of erlotinib in the metastatic setting, where studies have been conducted in North America, adding it to gemcitabine in the localized pancreas cancer setting didn't actually appear to add, and it may even have increased side effects. So that's going to cause some further evaluation of using that drug in localized pancreas cancer. But the second conclusion was that the addition of radiation didn't appear to add to the overall control of the cancer for patients with localized pancreas cancer who'd initially received chemotherapy. And again, I'm just being very deliberate about describing the group of people that this is potentially applicable to, as it's not an automatic interpretation that radiation doesn't help. But at least it results in pause, and it's going to result in an evaluation of how we approach patients with localized pancreas cancer, in that while normally we do think of, after a period of time, of incorporating radiation for people whose disease remains controlled, this study suggests that that may not necessarily be warranted. But a few caveats to keep in mind: that these results are maturing, that there wasn't a negative impact to the addition of radiation, meaning that people actually tolerated the treatment quite well. And there are selected groups of people, and it's a subset of patients who may be candidates for future surgery, that where we do think the inclusion of radiation may be potentially important. So I think a lot to learn as the final results of this mature over the next couple of years, but there were some hints as well, and this is an area where there's a lot of focus on in pancreas as well as other diseases, of trying to identify something called a predictive biomarker or a characteristic of either an individual patient or their disease that might tell us that they may benefit from one treatment versus another. And at least in this study, some preliminary analysis suggests that circulating tumor cells in the blood may help refine this treatment decision-making. So in North America right now, I think we're all sort of digesting this information and seeing how it applies to patients. But at the current time, one would say that options for patients with localized disease would be either to continue chemotherapy or to consider radiation, but it doesn't appear that the inclusion of radiation is a better way to go. It's an alternative option. So moving now to a slightly different topic in the metastatic and locally advanced setting, and these results were results that won't actually change practice, but like to mention it as it was a large study in pancreas cancer looking at the first vaccine conducted in a big phase 3 setting. This vaccine was based on something called telomerase, which is involved in controlling our genetic makeup or DNA, and it's something that is present in a lot of people with pancreas cancer and not so much in normal adult pancreas cells. So this vaccine had shown some preliminary promise, and it was evaluated in this study from the UK group. The data presented by Dr. Middleton is called a Telovac vaccine trial, looking at the addition of this vaccine to gemcitabine and capecitabine, a combination that's a commonly used combination in Europe for the treatment of pancreas cancer, which is not operable. And here, while the vaccine was safe and well tolerated, it did not appear that administering it together with chemotherapy or administering it following chemotherapy added to an improvement in outcome. It was noted, though, that there was a subset of patients who did appear to have a brisk immune response, and in other settings with vaccines, we know that an immune response may be a predictor of improved outcomes, so there's interest in going back and just sort of fully teasing out whether there are subgroups of patients within this large study that may have had some benefit. But for the most part, at least in its current format, this is not a strategy that will go forward in pancreas cancer. So to sum up, I think there were three main conclusions from this ASCO meeting: that we have a new option for treating advanced disease, and again, options are good. So gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel will now become a frontline choice, along with FOLFIRINOX, which is another commonly used chemotherapeutic combination for people who have a good level of functioning. We have information regarding an assessment of S1, an oral version of 5-FU, from a Japanese study that suggested in Japan that medication will become part of standard postoperative treatment. And we all recognize, though, that further development in U.S. and Europe is required. And in the locally advanced setting, we have information regarding refining the use of radiation for patients with non-operable pancreas cancer, that it's an equally valid strategy not to be routinely incorporating radiation in this setting. But again, from all these studies, we have more to learn, which will allow us to better select a treatment for a given patient. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly, for just a very outstanding presentation and for providing so much information to our audience about new treatments for pancreas cancer and also for these new options that that you provided. So thank you very much, and I appreciate very much your presentation. Our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor, and Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics. He's also Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's Co-Director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center at Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. Now, Dr. O'Connor is going to address lymphoma updates, research findings reported at ASCO, and implications for the treatment of lymphoma. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you again for all that you do through cancer care, helping patients get as much up-to-date information as they possibly can to help them fight this disease. Again, this year, ASCO proved to be a very exciting venue with lots of new and interesting data being released in the care of different subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and I'm going to touch on what I think are some of the highlights, trying to emphasize how many of the new drugs drugs that are being developed for this disease are now beginning to be integrated with many of the standards of care that we use for the many different subtypes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. One of the first interesting studies was with a drug called idelalisib, which is a relatively new drug, had historically been referred to as Cal-1101. And idelalisib is a PI3 kinase inhibitor that selectively affects what we refer to as the delta isoform of this particular enzyme, which we've actually discovered in recent years is really important and commonly mutated in many different kinds of lymphoma. John Leonard from Cornell actually presented a very interesting update of a phase 1 study where there was a planned evaluation of the combination of idelalisib with rituximab, idelalisib with bendamustine, and idelalisib with the combination of bendamustine and rituxan. And as many of you know, bendamustine has moved rapidly into the frontline care of many patients with indolent lymphoma. So this represents a potential strategy to really improve upon what we're historically doing with the rituxan-bendamustine combinations alone. Idelalisib is a very interesting oral drug that patients take twice a day, and Dr. Leonard presented the data on about 78 patients, and he demonstrated that overall the integration of idelalisib with rituxan, bendamustine, or both produced a very consistent overall response rate of about 80% in the patient study, 70 to 80%. But what was really interesting is the demonstration that the complete response rate improved dramatically when all three drugs were given simultaneously, those three drugs being idelalisib, rituxan, and bendamustine being given in combination to patients with a number of different indolent lymphomas, including marginal zone lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, as well as follicular lymphoma. Interestingly, the drug combinations were very well tolerated, with the predominant side effects predominantly being fever, and in some cases there is a effect on your liver enzymes, namely a modest increase in your liver function tests that seem to be a class effect associated with these PI3 kinase inhibitors. This data is now giving rise to some randomized trials to definitively evaluate the contribution of idelalisib to the combinations of rituxan and bendamustine to determine if it's truly better than taking rituxan and bendamustine alone. In line with the idelalisib story, Steve Horowitz from Memorial Sloan Kettering presented an update of another PI3 kinase inhibitor called IPI-145. Now, in contrast to idelalisib, IPI-145 is a strict delta inhibitor of this enzyme. So again, there are many different forms of it, and we're still scientifically trying to sort out what's the relative importance of these different isoforms of this enzyme to the pathogenesis of different lymphomas. IPI-145 is a oral drug that's given twice a day, and very similar to the idelalisib, as I mentioned before, is associated with a modest increase in some liver enzymes, including your AST and ALT, but these seem to be largely reversible. There also seems to be some very manageable neutropenia. Dr. Horowitz talked about 55 patients from the study, 22 of whom were evaluable for response, and one of the interesting different take-home messages from that presentation was that this is a molecule that seems to have interesting activity in T-cell lymphomas, and as many of you are aware, the T-cell lymphomas represent a subset of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma for which we desperately need new therapies, and this seems to have some very promising activity and is now leading to some very concentrated and focused studies in patients with T-cell lymphoma. I think one of the more interesting presentations actually focused on a target that we know to be ubiquitously important in all different kinds of cancer, but we know to be pretty important in lymphoma, and that target is BCL2. BCL2 is a family of different proteins that are known to regulate the induction of programmed cell death or apoptosis in many different cancers. And so, in fact, there are many different kinds of lymphoma like follicular lymphoma and CLL and others that have markedly elevated levels of BCL2 and related proteins. And this confers a mortality advantage, a survival advantage to those particular cells. So one might intuitively think that if I can inhibit that survival message from the tumor cell, I should be able to lower the bar required to induce those cells to undergo cell death. Historically, there was a compound known as ABT-263 that had been studied in the clinic that also inhibited BCL2, but that predecessor drug was actually associated with significant thrombocytopenia that limited our ability to increase the dose of the drug to the point where we could get meaningful therapeutic effects. This new molecule, ABT-199, is actually redesigned to be selectively effective against BCL2 without being associated with the low platelet counts that we saw with many of the other BCL2 analogs. This study was a phase 1 reported by the group from Dana-Farber, where they treated 31 patients. And remarkably, of the patients they studied, patients with mantle cell lymphoma seemed to have a dramatic response to the drug, with 8 out of 8 patients with mantle cell lymphoma attaining some form of remission, and many other patients with other subtypes of the disease also having significant shrinkage of their disease. This is very, very early in development, and there are now plans to begin to look at combinations of ABT-199 with conventional chemotherapies like Rituxan bendamustine, as I mentioned earlier, and even in addition to combination chemotherapy regimens like R-CHOP, where the addition of a drug that really minimizes those survival signals in the tumor cell could have a profound therapeutic effect on the tumor cell for the patient. Mike Williams continued to present some updates on the role of lenalidomide in mantle cell lymphoma. And some of you may be aware that the U.S. FDA just recently granted full approval for lenalidomide in patients with mantle cell lymphoma only about a week or two ago. That approval was based on the treatment of 137 patients with mantle cell lymphoma that had relapsed or was refractory to conventional chemotherapy. Lenalidomide is an oral drug that is an immune modulatory drug, so it's intended to try to stimulate your own immune system against the lymphoma. The data that convinced the FDA to grant a full approval was based upon an overall response rate of 28% with a very clinically significant duration of response of about 16 months in that patient population. And Mike actually presented some details looking at the different subgroups of patients with mantle cell lymphoma, meaning those that had relatively high adverse prognostic features, those that might have had a bulky disease. And he looked at all the different clinical parameters that we might associate with more unfavorable or more challenging disease, and remarkably found that the drug actually had sustained activity and consistent activity across the entire population of patients with mantle cell lymphoma, which in many cases was irrespective of those other adverse prognostic features of the disease that we've historically documented. I actually had the honor to present an update on a new drug called belinostat in patients with T-cell lymphoma. It was a report of the BELIEF trial. The peripheral T-cell lymphomas represent a pretty challenging group of diseases for which we now have a number of new drugs that have been approved along the accelerated path by the FDA, including pralatrexate and romidepsin. Belinostat is a hydroxamic acid very similar to another drug that's been FDA approved in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas called vorinostat. And based on 129 patients with relapsed and refractory disease, the BELIEF trial found an overall response rate of about 26% in this population with a median duration of response in excess of a year, which is considered to be highly significant in this particular patient population. One of the highlights, or maybe two of the highlights, that came out of the BELIEF study were that the drug was highly tolerable, was very favorably tolerated with very minimal side effect profile, and it appeared to exhibit significant activity in a subtype of T-cell lymphoma called angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. So we're now beginning to look at the combination of belinostat with other traditional agents used for the treatment of T-cell lymphoma, and most of us believe that the tolerability of belinostat will allow it to combine very favorably with other chemotherapy drugs. Anis Yunus also presented an interesting study, a phase 1 trial, looking at the combination of ibrutinib, which is a new BTK inhibitor targeting the B-cell receptor in B-cell lymphomas, and beginning to look at the combination of ibrutinib and R-CHOP. And it's intended to actually become integrated into the standard upfront conventional care of patients with aggressive lymphomas. And he reported on 17 patients in a very early study, all of whom had CD20 positive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the very good news here is he doesn't have enough data yet to be able to tell us about whether this is going to be more efficacious or not. That will require a randomized study that is being planned. But he did show that ibrutinib combined very favorably with R-CHOP and didn't markedly increase the toxicity of the R-CHOP chemotherapy regimen. So that's good news for our ability to try to add new drugs to those standards of care to try to change that natural history. Lastly, I'll comment on what may be some of the newest and for patients some of the most important studies that have emerged, and that regards the role of using post-surveillance CAT scans and PET scans in the evaluation of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. All of us are now intimately aware that CAT scans and PET scans do expose patients to small amounts of radiation that over the duration of their disease may be associated with some increased risk of cancer, and there's certainly been a lot of discussion of this in the lay press. But some interesting studies presented from the Mayo Clinic looked at over 644 patients. And what they actually found is that when they looked at patients who were scheduled to get a CAT scan that had been routinely prescribed by their physician at 4 or 6 month intervals following chemotherapy, they actually discovered that more than 62% of all the patients that were identified as having relapsed disease were identified based upon symptoms that they reported to the doctor and were not routinely identified by the post-treatment surveillance CAT scan. So most of us are used to thinking about the detection of relapse disease by just looking at those CAT scans that we get at 4 or 6 month intervals, identifying relapsing disease and then treating it. But it turns out that most patients who present with relapse disease had other issues. They had symptoms, they had abnormal labs, or they had abnormal findings on physical exam. And it was actually the composition of those non-CT-based findings that led to the diagnosis of relapse disease, calling into question what the real role of all those CAT scans that we get and what the real role of all that radiation exposure might be in this patient population. And amazingly, they found that only 1.5% of all surveillance scanning actually detected relapse disease. So clearly, this is a very interesting finding and one that needs to be vetted and validated in larger groups by other centers, but it begins to really raise the idea that has been promoted in the lay press, which is, are we getting too many CAT scans, and what do we really need in order to follow patients comfortably and safely? So I hope I've been able to touch on some of these key issues, which I think are leading to a change in the natural history of many of these diseases. Either many of these new drugs, which when integrated with conventional standards of care, will increase our ability to cure those diseases, and that's certainly happening in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and Hodgkin's disease, or conversely, many of these new drugs may afford new opportunities to manage the disease in a safe, relatively non-toxic and convenient fashion by offering oral drugs that may help us manage these diseases as chronic diseases. So whatever the contribution, either prolonging or converting these lymphomas to chronic diseases or increasing the cure rate out front, I think this ASCO was highly significant for demonstrating that we're beginning to take those steps to look at how to change those standards of care and improve the quality of care for all patients with lymphoma. Thank you so much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, Dr. O'Connor, that was a wonderful presentation and wonderful to hear that the ASCO meeting really contributed so much to the care of people with lymphoma. And thank you for identifying all the innovations that have occurred that were reported at ASCO. So thank you so much. And I know that people will take these back to their treating healthcare team and learn a great deal from this. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University. And as of August 1st, Dr. Morrow will be Program Leader for CML and Myeloproliferative Diseases at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He will also be Professor of Medicine while Medical College, Cornell University. Dr. Morrow is going to address issues around leukemia, and he's going to present to you leukemia updates, research findings reported at ASCO, and implications for the treatment of leukemia. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thank you, Dr. Mester. I'm glad to join you today and to give you an update on leukemia findings from ASCO 2013. Now, as many of you may know, I study CML mostly, so starting with that, we have essentially continued long-term follow-up from a host of medications that have been developed for CML. There are now 5 tyrosine kinase inhibitors approved for CML, imantinib, nilotinib, dasatinib, and 2 recently approved drugs, bosutinib and ponatinib. At the ASCO meeting in 2013, recently, we saw updates from randomized trials comparing nilotinib or Tasigna with imantinib or Gleevec as first therapy for patients with CML. We now have 4 years of updated data showing us some of the improvements we've gained by using our second generation or newer medications first rather than Gleevec. Now, Gleevec is still a good treatment for CML, there's no doubt, but some of the responses with regards to molecular remissions, protection against progression, and also careful observation of any late side effects you might see from nilotinib, such as vascular disease or pancreatic enzyme elevation, seem to be quite balanced, and I think the results are looking still encouraging and really pushing us forward in CML to want to use our newest drugs first. We also saw some more complete data on the most difficult of situations when someone has CML in a highly resistant form and hasn't had success with previous treatment, and that patients have used ponatinib or Iclusig, drug just approved this past year. And we saw some of the details of when a patient, and the rare circumstance of when the drug may not work and when mutations may develop, that we may have a more complex type of mutation called a compound mutation, and I think more research into this area will be essential to understand some of the most select forms of resistance. But ponatinib, indeed, is an excellent addition to our armamentarium for CML, and is a drug which will find its way into our algorithms. And, in fact, an important randomized trial comparing ponatinib with imantinib for patients with newly diagnosed CML is now running, and I encourage everyone to look for that if you know someone with CML or are interested in clinical trials for that question. We also saw the more details about patients switching therapy from imantinib to nilotinib as a way to improve their molecular response with longer-term follow-up from a trial called the NEST-CMR study, which was encouraging as well. I think we're moving in a direction where we may actually be able to envision CML as a disease that can be functionally cured. And with being able to place more patients into deep molecular remission, that may be more achievable and may allow patients entry into discontinuation trials. Turning a bit towards other leukemias, there was definitely excitement overall for the field of targeted therapy. And in the field of CLL, there were multiple medications which got attention at ASCO 2013. There's a drug that's been now widely studied called ibrutinib, Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which has continued data. And I think a bit more newer data on 2 additional compounds. One, obinutuzumab, which in the German CLL study was, the drug's also known as GA101, was given with chlorambucil or versus another combination of rituximab and chlorambucil. And this new combination really showed a reduction in progression of patients' CLL and a doubling of their progression-free survival. And this is a newer version of the anti-CD20 therapy we've seen developed so nicely in CLL and lymphoid malignancies, a so-called glyco-engineered antibody. And this is quite exciting data. Also exciting was the drug known as GS1101, which is a PI3 kinase inhibitor. This drug goes by the name idelalisib, and drug in combination with Rituxan in patients who hadn't had any previous treatment was remarkably active and gives us yet another combination which may be better over the long term and may offer different side effect profile and perhaps deeper remissions with time. So the spectrum of targeted therapies in CLL continues to expand quite nicely. Probably the most exciting therapy that might apply to all cancers, and some of my colleagues, if they haven't spoken about it already, probably will, is immunotherapy. And the combinations of anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies or immune modulating therapies around the T-cell and its regulation may be able to work its way into both chronic lymphoid and chronic myeloid leukemia. And I know that combination has shown great promise in melanoma with data from this meeting and beyond. And I think we'll look for those studies in CML. And all of this brings home the important message that clinical trials are really the essence of how we move the field of leukemia forward in blood cancers. Of course, being diagnosed with a blood cancer or having a loved one with a blood cancer is a devastating time, and support is needed, and cancer care and other organizations are obviously there for us, and we're, as physicians, are there for you as well. But if possible, it's always good to try to open the door and to seek newer treatment options and to be open-minded about clinical trials, to communicate with your healthcare team about them, because there are many new options available, and often we're looking for specific types of patients with specific profiles of leukemia currently, with specific markers nuances to their disease. So it's really become a field where we need to reach out more to our patients, and our patients hopefully can reach out more to us in order to access the best treatment possible for blood cancers. So ASCO 2013 was pretty exciting, not so much in CML, although we have very nice long-term data. I think with leukemia in general and the advance of targeted therapy, and I think we're seeing a renaissance and more advance in immunotherapy, so look for advances in those areas. Thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it back to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow, for such a wonderful presentation and for these updates and really for all the new information that you've provided. Thank you so much.
Our next speaker is Dr. Terry Day, and Dr. Day is Professor and Director, Head and Neck Tumor Center, Hollings Cancer Center, Medical University of South Carolina. And Dr. Day is going to be addressing oral and head and neck cancer updates, research findings reported at ASCO, as well as the implications for the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Day.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here with Cancer Care again, and we appreciate the opportunity to participate in this teleconference and give an update on ASCO 2013. I'd like to begin by doing a very brief overview of head and neck cancer so that our audience is clear on what head and neck cancer represents. I'll get to the ASCO updates after this brief summary. Although it is known that head and neck cancer represents the sixth most common cancer in the world, in the United States, one subset of these cancers is rising rapidly in incidence, and it includes cancers of the tonsil and base of tongue. These cancers are commonly found now in Caucasian males, usually in their 50s, who are non-smokers or only social smokers. This does seem to be related to human papillomavirus, or HPV, in the majority of the cases. Studies over the past several years have also revealed that smoking seems to affect the cure rate, with the amount of tobacco use related to survival, particularly when combined with HPV status. I would like to now discuss the treatment of head and neck cancers. It's well understood from scientific research and clinical trials, as well as published experiences, that each stage, site, and type of cancer should be treated a certain way. However, as more information becomes available, the controversies and options for each stage and site may become confusing to the patient and family during such a strenuous time. Head and neck cancers, like the aforementioned cancers tonight and during this conference, are often treated by stage, and a patient should ask what type of cancer they have, where the cancer started, and what stage it is in. Hopefully, their caregiver and family members will be there and help them understand during the visit with their physician as to these issues related to their cancer. This will then allow them to understand why a certain treatment is recommended. Cancers are typically treated according to the stage. In brief, most oral and pharyngeal cancers, which are a type of head and neck cancer, are staged by size in 2-centimeter increments. Thus, a stage 1 would be 0 to 2 centimeters, a stage 2 would be 2 to 4 centimeters, and a stage 3 would be greater than 4 centimeters, and so on. Now, let me summarize the treatment in a few sentences, and then we'll go on to the ASCO updates. In general, all head and neck cancers, and head and neck cancers really refer to the oral cavity or mouth, the pharynx or throat, and the larynx or the voice box, and each of these subsites has different types of cancers that might be treated differently. In general, all these sites are treated with either surgery or radiation that comprise the curative treatment modalities. Most head and neck cancers, however, will be treated with combination of treatment that include a variety of combinations and sequences of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. In brief, early stage or stage 1 or 2 cancers can be treated and cured with either radiation or surgery, and these can be used alone without the need for any chemotherapy. However, advanced or stage 3 and 4 cancers are often treated with one of three combinations: surgery followed by radiation, or combined chemotherapy and radiation together. Sometimes this chemotherapy might include a targeted therapy. The third option is surgery and radiation and chemotherapy to follow the surgery. Again, targeted therapy might be used, such as cetuximab, in addition to the radiation. When people have spread of cancer beyond the head and neck region, which is referred to as metastatic disease, various options for chemotherapy or targeted therapy regimens are available. We do recommend that patients seek care in multidisciplinary settings and consider clinical trials when seeking care for their cancer and treatment, as these often are the cutting-edge options for treatment of their cancer. I'm now going to go on to an ASCO update for 2013. One of the most exciting topics presented this year at ASCO relates to the Cancer Genome Atlas. In particular, there is one now for head and neck cancers, and this includes 279 head and neck cancer patients' tissues that have been evaluated in the cancer genome. One of the presentations was by Dr. David Hayes out of the University of North Carolina. He started by presenting the comprehensive genomic characterization of squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck. For those that don't understand, this is actually looking at some of the genes and the molecular pathways for these specific cancers in the head and neck. Out of these 279, about 15% were related to the human papillomavirus. He presented that newly identified mutational and structural alterations in head and neck cancer had information on genetic signatures and molecular classifications. There are also new subcategories of tumors, and these can hopefully lead to novel diagnostic and treatment options for patients in the future. Dr. Jeff Myers out of MD Anderson in Houston also presented an update on the Cancer Genome Atlas and gave some very insightful thoughts on what's been found thus far. Much of this data is preliminary in nature, and other studies are underway to look even deeper at some of these molecular changes. Dr. Christine Chung out of Johns Hopkins presented further information related to the early results of the analysis of a subset of tissues available in the Genome Atlas. She specifically discussed the benefits of the genomic report and what to tell the patient. In this presentation, she reviewed the TGCA, or Genome Atlas, data and molecular classification of head and neck cancers. This included information related to the classical, mesenchymal, and basal subtypes of HPV-associated head and neck cancers, with the cure rate following respectively with classical better than mesenchymal, which is better than the basal. She summarized that molecular testing and genomic analysis of individual patients' head and neck cancers is now available. However, it is expensive and not yet the standard of care. Currently, it is still used for research purposes. I'd like to now proceed on to some of the clinical trials presented at ASCO. Dr. Maurer presented a preliminary report on the clinical trial related to de-intensification of treatment for HPV-related oropharyngeal cancers in ECOG 1308. De-intensification is lowering the dose of radiation and hopefully reducing the side effects from the radiation treatment. In this study, patients undergo induction therapy with chemotherapy alone with the combination of cisplatin, paclitaxel, and cetuximab, and then are treated in two different ways. Those who have no evidence of cancer left undergo cetuximab and low-dose radiation 254 Gray. However, those who have the same amount of cancer left after the chemotherapy or only a partial reduction then undergo full dose of radiation to 69 gray and also get cetuximab. The early results show very similar rates of progression-free survival and low rates of distant spread of their cancer in each group. This is encouraging. However, longer-term follow-up should shed more light on whether this lowering the radiation dose can reduce the side effects while also maintaining a good cure rate. Another study that was presented was by Dr. Mira presenting some data from ECOG on ERCC and HPV status in recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancer. It appears from this study that those who undergo salvage therapy or treatment after a previous treatment who are HPV-associated cancers have an opportunity for longer cure rates when they're treated with chemotherapy. Finally, another study was by Dr. Ghi from Venice, Italy, who presented on a phase 2-3 study comparing combined chemotherapy and radiation therapy versus cetuximab with radiation therapy with or without induction docetaxel, cisplatin, and 5-fluorouracil in locally advanced head and neck cancer. And thus far, the studies are showing that there are very similar cure rates with these different regimens. Dr. Chung, who I mentioned earlier, also presented another study that assessed the role of P16, which is sometimes a surrogate marker for HPV, as an independent prognostic marker that may also be independent of HPV status in the non-base of tongue and tonsil sites, and that its presence may portend a better cure rate. I'd like to end by going over a study on swallowing therapy and a presentation on surgery. The role of swallowing therapy was presented by Dr. Jan Lewin out of MD Anderson in Houston, and she presented on the importance of continuous swallowing during treatment for head and neck cancer in a retrospective study, and she called it eat and exercise. This meant continue to eat and exercise your throat muscles, and that this showed a reduction in feeding tube duration and improved return to normal swallowing. She discussed the use it or lose it theme, implying that continued muscular function of the throat muscles helps maintain swallowing function rather than relying on feeding tubes alone. Dr. Ralph Gilbert from Toronto presented on the role of surgery in the chemoradiation era and discussed the complexity of doing surgery in a previously treated radiation or radiation and chemotherapy field for those patients that have recurrence of their cancer after chemotherapy and radiation. He reported that these patients also require complex reconstruction and that these patients should be treated in a major tertiary care multidisciplinary center rather than community hospitals. In summary, head and neck cancers are undergoing increased scrutiny into the types of cancers along with molecular markers associated with the various subsites. It is important to understand the role of human papillomavirus and smoking as causes of these cancers and their relationship to the outcomes with treatment. Patients should request HPV testing if they have a base of tongue or tonsil cancer if it was not discussed with them. We also encourage multidisciplinary care of all head and neck cancer patients and that clinical trials should be considered for each cancer. I would like to once again thank Cancer Care and Carolyn for allowing us to participate in this teleconference. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Day, for just a wonderful presentation. So very much information for everybody and really very up-to-date and a lot of promising information for all the participants in terms of oral and head and neck cancer. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And our next speaker is Dr. Gregory Daniels, and Dr. Daniels, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Diego, Rebecca and John Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to address melanoma updates, research findings reported at ASCO, and the implications for the treatment of melanoma. It's now my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Daniels.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I just want to congratulate those that are still on the call. You made it. This has been a really exciting program. And I just want to say that ASCO 2013 had a new word associated with it, and that was wow. We really got some exciting data presented and some clear paths forward that for melanoma I get to discuss. And what I'm going to try to do is show how that's creeping into the other tumor types that's been alluded to by the other discussants. And so, you know, the general theme that we're all trying to do in cancer care is to try to personalize our approaches, to minimize the toxicities for patients, and improve quality of life and cancer responses. And the two general ways that modern oncology is tackling this are through what's called the personalized therapies or targeted therapies. And then building steam has been the immune therapies. So targeted therapies go after the Achilles heel of a cancer. This isn't unique, again, to melanoma. You heard about it in the colorectal presentation and lung cancer, HPV associated with head and neck cancers. These are all giving us insights, understanding the genetics to go right after the cancer and, again, personalize our approaches. And immune therapies, another general approach, is to try to modify the body's response and allow a switch from the body supporting or, you know, tolerating a tumor growth to then instead rejecting it, which is the ultimate goal. And what I'm hearing more and more, which is really exciting, is medical oncologists using the word cure. And I think it's the convergence of these approaches and a lot of hard work that's starting to allow us to use that word. So last year for oncology, or for melanoma, we got a glimpse of both. And just before the meeting, two new targeted agents were approved for melanoma, and that was dabrafenib and trametinib. And these inhibit, again, a pathway that's found in melanoma as well as some other tumor types. A sister compound, selumetinib, is also a MEK inhibitor. And I'm going to diverge just a second to talk about a group of melanoma patients that don't get enough attention, and that's uveal or ocular melanomas. These are uncommon. They have a relatively unique genetic pathway, and they've been particularly resistant to benefit from our typical usual therapies. They're also very unpredictable and cause a lot of anxiety for patients, just the threat of these tumors coming back over time. But what was presented were, because of insights into genetics, that we're getting a better handle on how to actually monitor these patients. It's been alluded to again that, you know, we do CT scans, maybe too much, maybe too little, and the genetics are helping us tailor these for uveal melanoma patients. A clinical trial, though, was presented that pretty much for the first time in my recollection showed a real positive value for patients with metastatic uveal melanoma, and that was using one of these targeted agents, a MEK inhibitor, that doubled what was seen for usual therapy for progression-free survival and had a very dramatic response rate for patients. And response rates, or tumor shrinkage, translates to overall survival. There's a trend towards better overall survival and quality of life improvements. And so again, we're getting insights into these Achilles heel pathways. Now I'm going to jump into the usual, which is cutaneous or skin melanomas. And you know, you've been on this call for about an hour and a half. We had almost 3 days of exciting talks on skin melanoma. It's going to be hard to condense it down to about 5 minutes. But we had, again, targeted therapies being highlighted with updates from last year. And we're moving from single-agent gene targets where we get resistance coming up in patients. And now understanding those resistance pathways and using additional targeted agents or complementary therapies. And Jeff Sossman presented an update using that approach, which is a combination of a BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, with a MEK inhibitor, trametinib. And again, these two drugs were just approved for melanoma patients. And in that study, confirmed what we had a suggestion of last year, which is this combination has not only higher response rates, but less toxicity for patients. And this was predicted in preclinical models, but a lot of stuff is predicted in preclinical models. This actually turned out to be true. The skin toxicities from single-agent BRAF inhibition was improved when one added a MEK inhibitor. And this was continued follow-up data with a larger patient population, which confirmed that. I'm going to jump into the other treatment arm that I see, which is immune therapeutics. And immune therapeutics have been around for a long time, different approaches, cancer vaccines, ways to stimulate the immune system. And for melanoma, we have two FDA-approved agents, interleukin-2, which was approved back in the 1990s, and ipilimumab, which was approved in the last few years. The advantage of immune therapeutics have been that, again, this targets the patient's body, not necessarily the tumor. So we have a more generalized, potentially more generalized window to get at the tumors. But these typically lead to more durable long-term responses. Their limitations had been that few patients did respond. They were difficult treatments to manage, and they're hard to predict who would benefit from that. And ASCO 2013 was a huge step forward on all these fronts, so addressing these shortfalls. First treatment I'll talk about is something called T-VEC, which was a use of intralesional or injection right into the tumor. And for melanoma patients, these can be on the skin or in lymph nodes. And this virus, which has been genetically modified to go in, infect cancer cells, cause their death, was shown in a phase 3 randomized trial to what appears to be the holy grail of this type of approach, induce a systemic and possibly durable effect for melanoma patients. An advantage of this would be very well tolerated in terms of therapy. You're injecting a small volume of a medication right into the cancer and not getting a lot of systemic approaches, so the what we term grade 3 or 4 toxicities were very low and appeared to give a hint that this was a good approach for harnessing that immune response. There are many other approaches out there being developed. I just can't touch on all those in terms of the intralesional injection, so I'm going to go right into what's been mentioned in almost every talk, which is immune checkpoint inhibitors, and PD-1 and PD-L1 stole the show. ASCO 2012 had Dr. Topelian at Johns Hopkins present data on PD-1 blockade and showed very impressive responses, not just in melanoma patients, but in heavily pretreated patients from a variety of tumor types. And ASCO 2013 was all about extending those observations, confirming them, and providing a way forward. So we had an update from her phase 1 data, which confirmed a very impressive overall response rate. And very wow-inducing were the median duration of responses were, for the responding patients, more than a year and a half for these patients. And a lot of these responses were being maintained at a meaningful rate beyond stopping therapy. And that's a very important thing. When you're talking about cure of cancer, you're not talking about giving a medication continuously for a chronic disease. You're actually giving a medication and then being able to stop the medication and not having the cancer come back. And so that's what we're starting to see with these immune therapeutics. Of course, there are challenges. That's why there's medical oncologists and healthcare providers. There's certainly toxicities from these, but they're starting to be predictable and manageable, and these are outpatient medications that are being developed. And we jumped from the melanoma group into the developmental therapeutics, but I'm going to do that because a lot of the data was generated in melanoma. And Roy Herbst presented data on the flip side of PD-1 blockade, which is PD-L1. And these are, again, antibodies that go in and block the brakes of the immune system. They all have some subtle differences and pros and cons of each, but there's a lot of excitement with many companies developing antibodies and literally tens of large clinical trials in development to confirm these responses. So with this PD-L1 antibody that Dr. Herbst presented, they did a phase 1 study, dose-escalated the antibody, and never met their maximum tolerated dose. And this is very exciting. This reflects that the toxicities from these medications are actually fairly low, that the grade 3-4, the severest toxicities, were just seen in a few patients. So not only do we have PD-1, we have PD-L1, which is the flip side. And as it's a phase 1 study, a lot of patients were recruited besides melanoma patients, and it was seen broad activity in melanoma, renal cell, colon cancer, breast cancer, head and neck cancer, non-small cell lung cancer. Continued on with Dr. Tony Rebus presenting a compound from Merck, again a phase 1 dose-finding study. But these are not phase 1 dose-finding studies where we just see a few responses and chase them. What Dr. Rebus was able to show was response rates approaching 50% of the patients with approximately 10% complete response rate, and that these benefits, again, appeared to be durable. Enough, again, to talk about the excitement of going on to a phase 2, phase 3 clinical trial development. And lastly, we got a glimpse of the future. If that wasn't enough to have these checkpoint inhibitors, we now have the possibility of combining these in a rational way. And Jed Wolchek from New York presented phase 1 data on blocking both PD-1 and CTLA-4. The other name for it is ipilimumab. And PD-1 blockade with CTLA-4 in this dose-finding study showed us that one advantage of targeted therapies initially was that we got rapid responses, and immune therapies were often delayed responses. But what Dr. Wolchek presented was the combination of PD-1 blockade and CTLA-4 blockade showed a rather rapid and deep regression of tumors for melanoma patients. And now we're getting response rates that were well in excess of 50% that, again, appeared on this short-term follow-up of about 11 months to start to look like they could be durable. Again, this is early data, small patient experience, and there definitely are toxicities, but this has already generated the excitement of going forward with a phase 3 combination study of PD-1 blockade and ipilimumab. So the future is very bright. It was an exciting time to be in Chicago, actually. It's hard as it believed to be a medical oncologist and get excited about stuff, but this was really a wow meeting. It really highlighted translational research, the collaboration between the patients who step forward and participate in clinical trials and their family support, the physicians, the basic researchers, and industry coming in and being real partners and moving the field forward. So I look forward to 2014. It's going to be even more exciting, and we can use the cure word a little bit more. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. That was a remarkable presentation. And, you know, you're the last presenter in this two-part series on ASCO updates and highlights, and I can't think of a more wonderful way to conclude today's program with, first of all, the wow of ASCO meeting and the fact that a look into the future and how exciting, how many advances there were and presented at that meeting. So thank you very much for your presentation. And I do want to remind all of you that this is a workshop, that today's workshop was an hour and a half workshop, but that in planning a program like this, we know that all of you listening have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour, and so one and a half hours today. And I do want to remind all of you that although the program will soon end, this particular workshop will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those really are endless, and I want to say a word about them. Cancer Care has a staff of actually many oncology social workers, and we provide a host of services, from support and counseling services, a chance to talk with someone on the telephone. We also offer online and telephone support groups. We offer practical and financial assistance, as well as these workshops on a variety of topics. And, of course, we have materials, fact sheets, and publications that we offer, and a very robust website with lots of information. perhaps most importantly, I would not want anyone to think that when this program ends, that you're out there all by yourself, that you're alone. I want you to know that you're part of the community of support here, and that we are here to help you and to provide support to you and to answer your questions. So although there was not a Q&A in today's program, if you have a question or you think of a question, don't hesitate to call our staff at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And I want to thank all of you for participating today. I want to thank all of our tremendous speakers, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.